Welcome to Chit Chat Stocks. On this show, hosts Ryan Henderson and Brett Schaefer analyze businesses and riff on the world of investing. As a quick reminder, Chit Chat Stocks is a CCM Media Group podcast. Anything discussed on Chit Chat Stocks by Ryan, Brett, or any other podcast guest is not formal advice or recommendation. Now please enjoy this episode.
Okay, welcome in everyone. This is Chit Chat Stocks. I believe we are live on the old YouTube channel. Go check that out. We do these live every week. We're having a little issue with the live stream connecting every time, so that's why I'm saying that. But my name is Brett Schaefer, and as always, I am joined by my good friend Ryan Henderson. We're talking stocks, we're talking investing, we're talking the financial markets. We're in the I'd say the end of the quarter is always the most boring part of the year, but we're going to have some fun topics. I got a good one that I think will probably be in the title here, or excuse me, Ryan has a good one that I think will probably be in the title for any new listeners, 7 Best Share Cannibals. Won't tease them out there, but I'm interested to see what Ryan's thoughts are for some of these large share cannibals out there. I have, there was an interesting exchange on the old financial TV from the Palantir CEO. I have some stuff on Adyen versus Stripe, and then the potential business and financial implications of the TikTok ban. I'm not going to talk whether we believe it's right or wrong. Well, maybe we will, but the key point will be what the impact could be on some of those large advertising businesses and social media companies. But before we get started, Ryan, did you listen to the latest episode of the J. Rowe Show? Because I thought it was quite fantastic.
I have not yet. It's in the queue. I've heard a lot of people imploring me to go listen. So I'm moving it up to the front of the queue, but I have not listened yet. You enjoyed it?
I did. It was with portfolio manager at Poland Capital. I actually, how do I say it?
Dan,
I
forgot something,
his name.
Right?
Yeah, I forgot his name, but go check it out. J. Rowe Show. I thought it was quite good for finding like a way to invest that makes sense in, you know, from a valuation perspective in, you know, finding what some might call growthier stuff, higher quality stuff, and having that connection back to valuation, I thought was, you know, a fantastic conversation.
Okay. Well, we've got some share cannibals that would maybe be included in the quality value camp, everything in there. So that was kind of my horrible way of moving into the share cannibal discussion.
Well, hey, Ryan, before we get started, you have a advertiser for the listeners.
That is right. We got to talk about our sponsor, the public.com. Options trading is live on public.com. And if you activate by March 31st, you can earn a rebate of 18 cents on every contract traded. Simply sign up at public.com and activate options to get a lifetime rebate. You don't even have to start trading right away. Meanwhile, if you want to switch from your current brokerage, Public will reward you with up to $10,000. It only takes a few minutes to kickstart your transfer with a simple online process. Join the thousands of traders earning a rebate of 18 cents on every options contract traded. But hurry, you have to activate by March 31st only at public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. You have to activate options account by March 31st for revenue share. Options are not suitable for all investors and carry significant risk. Full disclosure is in the podcast description. U.S. members only. That's our message from our friends at public.com. With that said, shall we talk about my share cannibal list?
We can. We have one comment first. Says, seems Brett forgot to change the clocks for daylight savings. That might have been the reason why I went an hour late, but that's actually not. I was traveling and we wanted to make sure I got in on time and Ryan didn't have to wait around until I arrived. But yes.
Yeah, should we give an update to the listeners? Our resident traveler is in Costa Rica.
Yeah. So, you know,
thoughts? Investable market?
Maybe. They seem more relaxed but, you know,
a leisure economy.
Yeah, the guy that drove me down said that they don't have an army, so the United States basically protects them. And I was like, okay, maybe, you know, the defense contractors? I don't know. I've only been here for less than a day, so I don't have any takes so far. But maybe in a couple weeks, something like that, we can give some insights for the listeners. All right, what do you got for us, Ryan?
Yeah, let's talk share cannibals. So I put together a list of, and I've been doing this a lot lately. I've really been enjoying using screeners. I don't know. I think it's just fun to generate potential ideas. And if I'm ever bored, want to look at a new company, I basically just put in a bunch of criteria that I think I would like. Obviously, it doesn't capture everything, but and it doesn't capture every company, but it gives me some new ideas. So this, I use basically a buyback share repurchasing screener to come up with a list of companies. And I'm not going to get into the every single parameter because it's not that important. This list is not, there are no specific criteria. It is subjective. It is my personal opinion on the seven best shared handles over the last decade. And it's not just whoever bought back the most, because by the way, a lot of the companies that bought back the most shares are either insolvent or they bought themselves back and they should have been investing in the business and they didn't really generate good returns and it doesn't look that promising from here. So I have avoided those and I'm trying to pick the seven companies that have had the most intelligent buyback programs and the companies who have been able to marry repurchases with investments back into their business. And so I'll go through my seven. They're in no particular order, but this is my list of seven good share cannibals that not only have been good repurchasers, but should continue to be good repurchasers moving forward. So I'm going to start with the first one. This is really, I lumped them together. I don't know if I should do this because it's kind of cheating, but O'Reilly Automotive and AutoZone, I lumped together. They have very similar total returns over the last decade. They have similar philosophies and they have a lot of the same, well, similar business models and similar tailwinds. There are some nuances. O'Reilly has actually grown a little bit quicker in terms of earnings. And they've done a little bit better with, I believe, the professionals segment and getting into like auto body shops and being a resource for them than AutoZone has. So they've grown a little quicker. It seems like their performance has been a little better over the last decade, but in general, the margins are similar. The business model is similar. The reason customers come to them is always similar. They are, a lot of this is things people need pretty quickly. They're willing to pay a pretty premium for some of these products because they're asking for the advice of the O'Reilly or the AutoZone employees. And so it's just a really good business. And the number of cars on the road continues to grow every year. So it's helpful and they've got a lot of tailwinds. The way I kind of structured this is I'm going to go through a couple of metrics. The total return, so we can get an idea of how well these companies have performed, how much they've reduced share count, whether or not they're growing, and then how much of their earnings have they used to buy back stock. So I don't know if this is already a term, but I'm calling it the buyback coverage ratio. So it's basically just the money spent on repurchases as a percentage of the net income. So if it's above 100%, that means they're adding some leverage in order to buy back stock, which can be appropriate for the right business. But if it's below 100%, that means they've been using less than all their earnings to buy back stock. So going through this, it's a little long-winded.
They could have a very strong cash flow conversion.
Correct.
That could be helpful as well. Yeah.
Exactly. So O'Reilly, total returns over the last 10 years, 634%. That, I believe, is double the market. AutoZone has actually outperformed that, 698%. AutoZone has bought back a little bit more stock. So O'Reilly's reduced their share count by 42% over the last 10 years. AutoZone has reduced it by 46%. But on the growth side of things, O'Reilly's grown operating income at 11% and AutoZone has grown at 8%. So like I said, and I took, that is nominal operating income. So that's not operating income per share, not earnings per share. That is something I look for in a great share cannibal, is a business that, if you exclude the buyback, are they growing at a decent pace? Then the buyback is kind of cherries on top, which I like. The buyback coverage ratio, they are both more than 100%. Now, O'Reilly's looks a little worse. They've spent 130% of their net income on buybacks, but it's kind of reverted over the last 5 years. It's changed. AutoZone is starting to spend more of their earnings on buybacks, whereas O'Reilly's kind of brought theirs down a little bit, but both more than 100%. Not too bad, not too crazy. I would say when looking or thinking about a share cannibal, O'Reilly and AutoZone are always top of my list. They are probably they have the characteristics that I would want to identify in any potential future share cannibals.
Yeah, where permanently undervalued, or I wouldn't say permanently undervalued. It's more of the sector they're in never really gets the, what you might call the sexy premium, where they're not going to be the Palantirs, the SaaS, the whatever you have it, that is the AI right now that just gets super hot from a valuation perspective. And the industry itself is durable somewhat. I mean, I'm sure there is some seasonality and perhaps some cyclicality with these businesses, but you have that where it's consistent cash flow coming in. And then, yeah, you know, if it's permanently, if the stock's permanently undervalued, well, that's a great combination if you consistently repurchase stock. As a little tease for next week, we're covering one of the best investors. Well, I guess we'll determine. He doesn't really care if we call him one of the best investors, but one of the most famous investors from the United Kingdom that does a lot of writing, named Terry Smith. And one of his key tenets is looking for strong cash flow conversion when finding a high quality company, and not like strong high cash flow conversion is indicative of like a quality company. And I think these two probably exemplify that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, they just really check the box across the board in everything I look for. It's like the market is growing. They're gaining share within the market. They have economies of scale and cost advantages, and they're intelligent with the capital at their disposal. So I really like it. The second one here.
Maybe go through them all, and then Tyler has a comment here and we can discuss.
Yeah, and I'll go a little quicker through the rest of these so we don't do this. We're not here for an hour and a half. Second one is Lowe's. Total return is 506%. They've reduced share count by 40%. They've spent 128% of their earnings on buybacks. This is one that has levered up progressively over the last, I guess, 5 or 10 years, probably encouraged by Bill Ackman, who's been not an activist investor, but a big investor in the company for a while. The operating income has grown, but revenue growth has not been really that crazy. I think it's been about like 4.5% annually over the last 10 years. So nothing too crazy, but their operating margins have expanded. They've done a good job returning cash to shareholders. If you look purely at the businesses, we're going to talk about Home Depot here in a second. They have returned way more cash to shareholders while growing at a slower pace, and they actually have, as of yesterday, identical total return. So it's a bit of a kind of just worse growth, better, not even better capital allocation, because Home Depot does a good job too. But because they trade at a discount, they haven't had to have as good of results as Home Depot in order to generate good returns for shareholders. So kind of interesting. Third one here, this is the biggest company on the list and one of the best returns, Apple. They have grown tenfold over the last year in terms of total return, and they've spent less than 100% of their net income on buybacks, only 99%. They are probably one of the most efficient companies in terms of big tech. They don't seem to be quite as wasteful as a lot of the big tech companies.
That's a low bar, though, so we should be fair.
It is, but what's that stat or that that anecdote about like their treasury department is like 6 people and it manages $100 billion.
It's much smaller than maybe other large companies. They run efficient in that regard, which is great because probably more people is worse for a company like that, for that section of a company. But they do spend a lot of R&D. What do they estimate? $10 billion or more on that car that just got scrapped.
Yeah, there's maybe some wasteful bets, but this actually surprised me. Revenue growth for Apple over the last 10 years has not been too crazy. I actually saw this the other day, and I want to make sure to pull it up and make sure I'm not just getting it wrong. But revenue over the last 10 years has grown at 8% annually, 8.4. The multiple EV to EBIT has grown at 12% annually. Their multiple has grown faster on an annual basis than their actual revenue, which is pretty insane.
Yeah, that it's a good combination for good trailing returns, but I'm not sure it's the recipe for what, you know, someone should expect on forward returns. It does come back to, I mentioned for my intro question, that latest episode of the J. Rowe Show, the guy he interviewed said that basically when they're making any assumptions for a, you know, high quality business, even if they think that it deserves a higher multiple, they want to make sure they can have adequate returns without multiple expansion. And then it's just a nice cherry on top, because you can't control the multiple. But I guess in Apple's case, they were able to benefit from both growth and multiple expansion.
Yeah, and they have had slight margin expansion, as well as there's been the mix shift to services revenue instead of just hardware. But anyway, the fourth one here is going to be RH, previously Restoration Hardware. I'll also say, big pet peeve for me that they renamed it RH. I don't know. I don't like it. It's frustrating to like, it's the same as the ticker. I kind of don't like when they have that. Whatever. Doesn't matter. Anyway, but they have bought back, I think, either the most out of this list, second most on this list. And it's been the most random, I guess, is maybe the way to put it. A lot of these companies, you look at the buyback, it's fairly consistent. There'll be years where they think they need capital, especially COVID. A lot of companies pulled back on their buyback program and they'll kind of draw it in. But generally, they're allocating whatever it is, all their net income, to share repurchases. RH will have years where they don't buy back any, where they buy back like a tiny amount. And then they'll lever up and buy back $2 billion in stock. And their buyback coverage ratio is 2x their net earnings. So over the last 10 years. But it's just so sporadic and so random. And the CEO is pretty forthright about this. It's not coincidence. He says, I'm going to buy back when I think it's the best use of capital. And they'll do it really aggressively. They took down share count, I want to say like, it was like 50% in a matter of 2 years. Or maybe it wasn't that much, 30% or something like that. They had a huge drop in share count in like 2017 timeframe.
Yep. And so, I believe financed by convertible notes. So taking on, while they're convertible notes, taking on some leverage to do so.
All right. This share count is down 53% over the last 10 years. Total returns, 356%. All these stocks have beaten the market over the last 10 years. Growth has actually been pretty solid. 13% growth in operating income. Although this is a business that it's a little lumpier just in terms of earnings. So they might have had kind of a deeper starting point so that it makes it look better. Fifth one here. Love this company, Domino's Pizza. I think it's one that has sort of the scale economy shared principle of they're driving lower. Because of the scale, because they have the uniform processes throughout, similar layouts. They manage all the marketing. They're able to deliver pizzas at a lower cost.
Same pizzas everywhere. Yeah.
Yep. They push them through in lower prices. You're getting that positive feedback loop with customers, all that. Anyway, great returns here. It's grown a little over sixfold in the last 10 years. They have spent well north of 176% of their earnings on buybacks. But they've reduced the share count by 37%. I did not know, this was the biggest surprise on my list. I did not know they were such a share cannibal. I didn't realize that's what they were doing with their capital. This is, by the way, people think of it as a pizza restaurant, pizza franchisor, very capital light. They are not putting out most of the capital. It's mostly the franchisees, which I guess that's a typical franchisee model, but they've done just an absolutely awesome job executing over the last 10 years. Any thoughts on Domino's?
Good business. And when they changed, or I think they brought in new management, not an expert on the company's history, but it was right around the great financial crisis. I don't think they were in a crisis, but they decided to change up the food quality, make it more consistent. There's just big complaints about how bad the quality was. And they did so, and they focused on the, you know, customer efficiency, low prices, all these deals, the app, the owning their delivery. And it just seems to work. It's a pretty easy model. And the franchisee model is going to be, as you mentioned, capital efficient. So it's going to have that cash flow conversion as opposed to maybe a Chipotle who owns all their restaurants. That could be the right move in the long run, but the downside is it's more capital intensive.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Number six. This one has not been really that much of a share cannibal, but I think they've been intelligent about the way they've rolled it out. So Home Depot, I think they're the biggest retailer in the US, actually, if I'm not mistaken, by market cap. I think they're bigger than Costco. They've had sixfold returns over the last 10 years. Share count's only down 24% over 10 years. So nothing crazy here, but they haven't spent a ton of their earnings on the buyback. They also have a dividend in place, but they've only spent 72% of their net income on buybacks. And they've really done a good job relative to Lowe's of growing the per store productivity levels. Their retail sales per square foot, if I pull it up here, let me just grab this real quick. Sales per retail square foot has grown at 6% a year. They've improved operating margins, especially at the per store level as well. And they've done a really good job optimizing the stores for pros. So good returns. They've been methodical about the buyback. They haven't juiced it too much. And they're actually increasing it now. The multiples come down a bit, and they've actually started to juice the buyback a little more now. Last one here, Murphy's USA. Gas station chain. This has actually had the best returns of all the stocks on this list. They've had better returns than Apple. They are up 12-fold over the last 10 years. They've reduced their share count by more than half, and their operating earnings have grown at 9.5% annually. And they've spent less than 100% of their earnings on buyback, so they haven't had to lever up to do it. I think this is probably the most impressive business on the list, and the one that is maybe the most surprising in terms of total return.
I agree. Well, I don't know if you should be surprised anymore, because we had the interview with the guys from Capital Mindset discussing this stock, and it was shocking how good this business is. But I think the key when looking at a share cannibal is there has to be doubt from Mr. Market. O'Reilly and AutoZone, there was doubt. Lowe's, Home Depot, there was doubt after the great financial crisis because of the collapse in home building demand and all that stuff, and just real estate. Apple, there's been doubts for years, I'd say maybe the last couple of years, there hasn't been as much doubts if we're going to go on the earnings multiple, but it traded at about 10, 15 times earnings for a long, long time. RH, there's been doubts. Domino's, there was a lot of doubts, and it's why it's, I think, a 100 bagger coming out of the GFC, or if not, really, really strong returns. Murphy USA, same thing there. And yeah, I think if you're looking at, because we have some questions here in the comments, what are like the best share cannibals for the next 10 years? I think you have to look at that on sort of a broader mindset of, okay, what are some companies I think are one in a durable industry, have good cash flow conversion, are going to trade at a low multiple, and are going to be pouring stuff into buybacks, cash into buybacks.
Yeah. Here's a good example of one that I call an honorable mention. That's not, I didn't call it a best share cannibal because I don't think it's that great of a business, but this really surprised me. And it just goes to show how much of having a good repurchase program comes down to what the market thinks of you. Dick's Sporting Goods has outperformed the S&P 500 over the last 10 years. I thought this business was screwed.
Well, I thought they were insolvent. I think we have the Seattle lens because I actually had a friend that worked there for a little while. And it's just that the theft issues make it seem like the business is, you know, terrible. But I think that might have just been a Seattle West Coast issue. You know what I mean there? That's what I've heard is like, oh, they have terrible theft issues, just like the Targets and the West Coast, just like the CVS's. And I was like, man, this business has got to be bad. But if you look at the performance, I mean, wow. Like, they really found their niche there. And I wonder why. Be an interesting one to look at, because I wonder why they seem to be the only, maybe not the only, but there's a lot of those old physical sports retailers that went
big
out of
box,
business.
Yeah.
A lot of, I wonder why they've succeeded and everyone else has failed.
Yeah, I don't know. They've bought back 34% of their stock and earnings per share have grown at 16% a year. It's, if you just asked me, what do you think Dick's Sporting Goods has done over the last 10 years? I would have guessed they were down 50% or more and struggling, and I would be dead wrong. So pretty impressive there.
That's the doubt, though. That's where the opportunity lies.
Yeah, and it constantly trades at like 10 times earnings. So it allows you to be, it allows you to do more positive things for your shareholders when you get that discount. Question here for you and for me as well. What are the qualities you look for in a potential share cannibal? One that you think this could take down a lot of stock and generate good returns for me in the coming years?
Okay, I'm going to take away the management part because obviously management has to be with you in returning that cash. And we've already talked about some of it where, but the key is starting low valuation. And I guess your ability to be a share cannibal kind of goes away if you start trading instead of 10 times cash flow to 40 times cash flow. But I don't think you're going to complain as a shareholder if you get a 4X from multiple expansion. But you, I think you have some notes here about like the ability to add cheap leverage. But I think consistent cash flow conversion is key for me. I mean, one company that's probably not going to be a share cannibal unless we get a huge narrative shift because they traded a premium valuation is Airbnb. But that's one where the cash flow characteristics of the business make it extremely attractive from a buyback perspective. You have Booking here as one of your honorable mentions as well. I think they probably have the same stuff there where you're collecting a lot more. The cash is just coming in at such an attractive rate versus even what your GAAP earnings are that if you trade at a low multiple, I mean, you can just take down the share count so aggressively. Other characteristics? I don't know.
I'll go through a couple of mine here. Yeah.
You go ahead.
A lot of it's the discount. The other part, I like to find businesses that are growing to begin with because it's just more sustainable. When you look at some of the, like if you just screen for biggest buyback programs, you get a lot of underperformers. People that were buying back that shouldn't have been, or people were buying back that maybe they should have been because the business was so bad, there was nowhere for them to invest, but they were buying back shares on a business that was failing. So there's a lot of those situations. I like to find businesses where there is some level of durable growth, either revenue, earnings per share, whatever it is. The second one for me, and I saw this a lot with the list today, companies that have used leverage or levered up over the last 10 years to buy back more stock. That's okay, first of all, because rates have been low over the last 10 years. But ideally, I want a company where they haven't levered up in the past to do it, because Lowe's, for example, has been able to buy back a lot more stock because they've increased the leverage. I think you want one where they either aren't levered up yet Sprouts Farmers Market was an example of one we were looking at over the last 5 years, where they really didn't have a whole lot of leverage, and you knew they could have to juice more buybacks, or they already have some leverage, but you think they can continue to lever up more. So I want ones where I don't feel like the low-hanging fruit and the increased debt is in the past. And then the last one is just consistency. I know the RH approach can work, but we've seen it go wrong as well, like Bed Bath & Beyond, for example. So I prefer ones where they're constantly buying back and they can kind of moderate it or turn it down as the valuation creeps up. So I don't really want the ones where it's sporadic buybacks. I really don't like that.
Yeah, makes sense. I think I agree with that. Consistency just makes things simpler. All right, we have a comment here that says ZZZZ, so I think that means that we're going long on this topic. We have a few questions here. What do you guys think are the best share cannibals over the next year? The next 10 years? Google and Meta? Match Group maybe? Questionable terminal risk and low valuation with no real reinvestment needs? And the criteria from Tyler is, you know, terminal risk, but accompanying low relative valuation. And there's something on here about home builders for Ryan, but I guess that's separate. Yeah, I think Match is a good candidate, but again, it is risky because one, there has to be that risk. Like if you look at some of the good companies on this list at the time, there was the narrative was a lot different on, I don't know, what their growth prospects were, how high quality the business was. I mean, a key one was Domino's, where people were like, they're just one of the worst brands out there. And it took 10 to 15 years to change it, but they did. And at the same time, they had a low valuation, bought back stock, used leverage smartly. Match Group makes sense. I think Alphabet would make sense if management, maybe if they had Apple's finance department or, you know, budgeting team, right? I don't know if they have that combination of the management team that makes sense, but they have been decent so far over the last few years at pouring money into buybacks. So I think if the valuation comes down to an attractive level of 10 times cash flow or something like that, yes, they can be one of those, but management's not as ideal.
Yeah, I mean, this is a good example of it. It's hard to be a great share cannibal because you not only need a discount in your valuation, but you need a discount for a while where like, Match Group right now, if you just modeled it out, yeah, they could buy back a lot of stock because it's trading at a discount. But if they really start to buy back a lot of stock, I think the valuation would probably re-rate, and because it would show the market that management is able to take advantage of it. So it's really kind of a weird, you have to be in a weird position where the market consistently thinks poorly of you.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if it's that or if the narrative could shift quickly if it's proven that there's durability, you know, in the sector. And with some of these other ones, it's just not sexy enough. And that's actually the benefit you're going to get. Murphy USA, perfect with that in that regard. But let's move on to some other topics. We don't want to take, I think we took about half the time there. We want to do some other stuff on this episode. I have some winners and losers from the week. I know you were tentative to talk about this one, but it was in the financial news on the financial TV. So I think it should be approved to talk on a no-name podcast. But did you see and or listen to the Palantir CEO?
Yeah, I heard it. This is probably the most unhinged CEO interview I've seen in the last 3 or 4 years. Maybe there's some others. The ones where the EV company CEOs are wearing hard hats were pretty hilarious, but this is more just bizarre is maybe the word to describe it.
Yeah.
Are you going to try to share this?
No, I'm going to figure out how to do that because the audio is really great and it's short. I think it's perfect for a podcast, but we have this new software. I knew how to do it on Zoom.
You want to describe what it is?
For anyone that doesn't know, you can probably find it either on Twitter or X or search it on Google. You'll find that it's like a 30-second clip. Basically, they were asking something and the founder CEO of Palantir responded essentially saying that short sellers are going with that classic line that short sellers are a bane on society. They're holding society back. All they want to do is see good companies fail. And essentially he's saying they're profiting off of the companies failing. And then he tosses in some like 20-second anecdote about the failing financing their cocaine habits, which I thought was bizarre, because if you spent any time with the investment community, you'll realize that, I mean, go to the Berkshire weekend. Like, it's all, we're all a bunch of nerds. Like, no one's, you know what I mean? Like, it's, I'm sure there are some of that, right? Like, in any group of people, but I think everyone embraces being almost like losers in that regard and just kind of nerds. And so I'd say it's the complete opposite. First off, maybe it was a hilarious interview, and you know, we don't, I think the more fun topic is how much, okay, let's say you, Ryan, are investing in Palantir, because I think when people listen to that, we know Palantir is a popular company, especially among the retail crowd, especially among the online communities that might listen to this show. And I'd say, like, Ryan, if you were one of those people and you saw this interview, what would be your thoughts as someone who's, you know, not trying to be on the right team, but trying to make money, you know, with your portfolio?
Yeah, well, I would think it's concerning. The reality is, with a lot of these companies that, where the shareholders kind of band together in a way, they feel like a group, like it's even Berkshire to some extent. You're gonna back what they say no matter what. Like, you almost give them the benefit of the doubt, and your filters for, okay, is what he's saying, does it make any sense at all? Like, even with Munger, a lot of Munger in China, a lot of people were like, no, I mean, it's Munger, so it's, I think he probably knows more. And it's like the same thing with the Palantir CEO, the AMC CEO, where you're sitting there and you're like, well, you know, I guess we got to trust him. He's our leader. So the problem is, in this case, and in almost all the cases, it's more of a watch what they do, not what they say. And someone brought this up today. And it's like, you talk about the evil short sellers. How about the evil long sellers? And he long has buyers, just been, buyers, yeah. No, the long sellers, he has just been selling stock over and over while like criticizing the short sellers. And it's like,
it's the same thing.
He just needs the premium.
It's the synthetic ladder attacks. I don't know. It's crazy. Okay, we got a comment here. Would you guys ever do a podcast where you discuss the qualities of your winning investments and the qualities of your losing investments, like a post-mortem to figure out where your circle of competence is? Yeah, I think that's good. Maybe, you know, I guess we're a long ways from the end of the year, but that could be like an end of the year type deal where we go through post-mortems on some stuff. Other comment, people either think Alex Karp is a fraud or a visionary. Palantir has been growing like a weed, but SBC is also a problem. SBC is, we're in a few Motley Fool articles on this company, given it's so popular. You know, it does quite well with those, the reads and the, you know, qualifying for some bonuses. So I'm not opposed to writing a, is this stock the next Magnificent Seven company that you need to own? And then if you go through the numbers, though, their SBC is, yeah, very high. It's like a 20%. It might be lower now. But you contrast that with a company that seems to perform quite well, wins a ton of customers from the government. Commercial customers are growing quite quickly. And when you read their stuff, even from the CEO, Alex Karp here, you're like, wow, they're kind of sharp. They know what they're doing. They seem like they're focused on winning customers, generating sales. But then when you see this type of thing, I think if I owned Palantir and I saw this clip, I would sell right away.
Well, I think this is just a good example of, and I'm not sure if they, I think they might have moved their headquarters, but it's a good example of the Silicon Valley culture being embedded in your company, right? It's employees first, shareholder second, and they reward the people in the business first. Salesforce had it for a long time. You can go down the line and just tick off every single, a lot of tech companies that are from the Silicon Valley area. When you get to public markets, it's like your exit. It's your and all your employees' exit. and it becomes this constant financier for your life. So, and especially when they're willing to give you a premium valuation, I think
here's what the pushback I think from people would be is Salesforce is pretty close to being a hunter bagger.
Yep.
So it's like
it worked.
I mean, it can work. The business is so damn good. But what I would say is, just for anyone that loves Palantir or any stock like this, I'm not trying to hate on your stock. I don't care if the company succeeds or fails. I don't have any vendetta against any companies. If their share count is going up by 20% a year, and that might be extreme, but let's say it's going up by 10% a year and revenue is growing by 10% a year, your revenue per share that you own is not going up. So it matters. And they tout like a 30, 40% free cash flow. I could be getting this number wrong, but they're touting a high free cash flow number, but it is with a high, high valuation and, you know, high level of SBC. And I'm sure their share count's not going up by that much because they're trading at like 20, 25 times sales, which is probably an issue in its own regard. But I think the biggest red flag for like the stock isn't the high valuation. It isn't that SBC. It's the fact that management, like, I don't care what they're doing as a company. It's whether I think this guy has a rational level, you know, level headedness.
Yeah. It's also worth mentioning that Salesforce built a CloudForce or a cloud-based CRM before anyone else. And I think the space is a little more crowded. So I wouldn't just anchor to Salesforce's returns for any software business that you own. But I mean, it can work if your employees are heavily incentivized and the software itself is really powerful and wins customers, then more power to you. The only issue for me with Palantir is that it's a black box, and I think they want it that way. They don't love to explain the depth of their products and like the nitty gritty. I know that I've seen some YouTube tutorials where they talk about it, but I think you kind of just have to trust that they're winning customers and the customers are paying more and the proof is in the pudding in that case.
Yeah. I wouldn't say that's a huge issue, especially because some of it's classified since it's military based, but you can talk, you're not going to make money.
It's like the Bezos thing where he did that interview with Lex Fridman, and he mentions that a lot of management teams today honestly don't know the metrics that matter to them, or they use metrics that really don't matter to measure the success of their job and the operation as a whole. I think this is a good example where if internally Palantir is using cash flow margins to measure it, and they're kind of being lackadaisical about stock-based compensation, then yeah, that's obviously not great for shareholders.
Okay, I'm going to go to a winner of the week, a company that we followed a long time. I think we've had some good podcasts out on it. So if you want to search in the historical archives we have, go check it out. It's a company that we don't own, though, given the valuation, unfortunately. And it is Adyen. Good tweet from Mostly Borrowed Ideas, runs a nice newsletter service. We've had him on the show before. I'll give him a follow. He says, since Stripe just published their annual letter, I just updated this chart. Both Adyen and Stripe are now growing at pretty similar rates, but Adyen has a way, he used a lot of Y's here, you know, whatever. you gotta get the people to read it online. Way higher margin than Stripe, and it's neutralized for any sort of exchange rates, I think. Maybe I'll share the screen here, actually, so anyone watching can see it. But Ryan, did you see this at all? And if not, I will show it to you right now.
I did see it. And this is another example of the different ideologies between companies built in Silicon Valley and company. Well, I guess it was technically built in Ireland, but really grew in Silicon Valley.
Stripe.
No, it's Irish. Stripe was. Yeah.
Okay.
Built in Silicon Valley versus being built elsewhere. It's just a different level of expenses. They pay employees more because that's what you have to pay to get certain employees. But then this is a good example of you don't need that many. Sometimes more people hurts you more than helps you. And I think that's kind of a big difference between Adyen and Stripe here.
Yeah. And let me, for the listeners, so we have basically total payment volume, which is pretty much going to translate to revenue for these payment companies that run very similar models from 2018 to 2023. In 2018, Adyen had $173 billion in USD. 2018, they had $173 billion USD. 2023, $1.057 trillion. Stripe, extremely similar, $170 billion 2018, and then $1.021 trillion in 2023. What's interesting is in 2019, Adyen had higher levels. 2020, 2021. Stripe had higher levels, which I think was probably the pandemic benefit to e-com, especially in the United States, North America. And then Adyen reaccelerated and started beating them in 2022 and 2023, although I'm sure they're not just focused on, you know, beating Stripe. That's probably not the priority. Where are you at, Ryan? Okay. Any thoughts there? Because I think it doesn't look that different because you'd say, okay, both companies are doing well, but Stripe basically doesn't make any money and Adyen has 50% margins. So it's so much more impressive to me that you can 10x revenue doing that. And yeah, sure, maybe Stripe has a great consumer surplus because they're helping publish the updated Charlie Munger book, which I appreciate. But should you really be doing that as a payments processor? I'm not so sure.
Yeah. I used to think like, well, I'm sure every employee helps a little bit in terms of driving revenue, but
no, some can hurt.
Joining FinChat, which we should probably talk about now, by the way.
Right. Yeah. Good point.
Joining FinChat's been an interesting experience because I could see how, and we haven't like done, we're not super acquisitive or anything like that, but I could see how if you were acquiring a different payment company. If you're a payments company, you acquire another payments company. There is a different setup on the back end. There's, you've disrupted the flow that you might have with existing employees because now you have to work with the employees that have come over. You have to relearn a whole bunch of systems. It slows everything down. And now there's a product that you haven't helped build. So it's harder to address the pain points and address any issues that come up. It's harder to ship products faster. This for Adyen, they've built everything from the ground up. So they can move so much faster. And it's one, I tweeted this out this morning, but it feels like one of the businesses where it's the clearest example of the impact that a company's culture can really have on the outcome. Because every company talks about whatever our culture, but this one, you see how much more customers they can win. You can see the higher authorization rates because they have a company that they built from the ground up. They do everything organically. It's really impressive. Stripe's obviously built a really good product as well. They've just hired more and earned no money in the process.
Yeah. And I actually haven't read their 2023 numbers. So if they made a little money, I take that back. But historically, they've been much less efficient. And I'm sure that their margin was not at Adyen's level. But why don't you talk about our friends at FinChat, Ryan, and where you can get, I know you mentioned like retail sales per square foot. You know, where can listeners find some of that high quality KPI data in an instant, you know, easy to use platform?
Yeah, finchat.io. We've had a lot of listeners already sign up using our code. I hope you're getting a lot of value out of the platform. For anyone that doesn't know, it is a stock research terminal. So look up any stock you want. They've got 100,000 stocks in total on the platform. 50,000 are active, more than 50,000 are active. They've got some old ones as well. They track that stuff. And then they've got segment and KPI data, like Brett mentioned, the retail sales per square foot, comp store sales, for Home Depot, they have tons that you can add, total store locations, lumber revenue. Basically, they segment everything out and they track really a lot of the metrics that matter beyond just the standard financial statements. There's a lot more to it. Check it out. It's finchat.io. If you end up liking it, you want a paid plan, finchat.io/chitchat will get you 25% off. That's finchat.io/chitchat. So appreciate everyone that's already used the code, and feel free to check it out.
Yep. Link should be in the show notes to get that discount. If you can't figure it out, email us. Our email is in the show notes, or find us on Twitter or X, and we'll help you out there. All right. Next, we got a comment that says, who is the winner of the week for the TikTok ban? And that's a great question, because that is actually next on my list here. For those maybe that aren't following, I'll give some quick context. The House of Representatives in the United States passed, which I should say is not a TikTok ban. The company is throwing out a lot of, I don't think I would call it, it's not propaganda, it's misleading info. I'd say on what the bill is, because it's what it would force them to do is divest any sort of relationship to the Chinese Communist Party or stuff like that. It would have to be, if it's in the United States, be an American-owned company. Whether you agree or disagree with that, I don't think that's the fun topic for this episode. I think that's going to be talked about on every single news thing for the next week or even longer. But what I was interested in thinking about is how it could potentially impact the Magnificent Seven and maybe some other companies out there, where you have a company that takes up so much time of people's entertainment hours, especially under 30. And if that goes away, which it technically wouldn't be a ban, but I guess they're treating it as a ban because for whatever reason, they think if this bill passes, it's going to go in. And I guess it passed the House of Representatives. It hasn't passed the Senate yet, but the President of the United States said that he would sign it into law if it got passed. So got quite a few boxes checked off here. But I had a tweet, and these are my thoughts, and I'm curious if you agree or disagree, who I think it positively helps if TikTok goes away. I think these are kind of indisputable. Amazon, Alphabet, Meta. I think it negatively could hurt, not directly, but indirectly, Apple, Nvidia, and Tesla, mainly from retaliation from the Chinese government. And I think Microsoft is probably neutral. Ryan, who do you think the ban could help or hurt? Maybe even non-Magnificent Seven companies.
Yeah, I don't know. Non-Mag Seven, I'm not 100% sure. Maybe Snapchat in some way, but probably not. I would think the time spent probably goes to Instagram and YouTube primarily, would be my guess.
Yeah.
So Netflix, Google and Meta.
Maybe Netflix. But yeah, I mean, definitely.
I'd be surprised. I'd be surprised if they were stealing that much share from like a Netflix, but I don't know, potentially. I think a lot of the TikTok users would still be looking for a mobile-based app where they can get engagement or content really quickly and shortest bite-sized content. And the way to do that is really YouTube and Instagram, and I guess Snapchat to some degree. I think they would benefit. The other part that I find interesting, and I'm surprised they thought this would be a good idea, but they pushed a notification to all TikTok users in the US that said, call your local representative and tell them you don't want TikTok banned and they're doing something wrong. And
it was misleading too, which is like part of the thing, is like they could push stuff that's not true.
Right. And basically all the representatives said, all the calls we got just hardened our belief already. It made it that much worse. And I think trying to influence votes and decisions is probably not the right way to go to get the government to be in your favor. So
that's true. If the whole point is that they can control the what young people think.
Outcomes, yeah.
Yeah, so it's like, oh, you kind of proved our point. We have a comment here that says, imagine if Amazon bought it and merged TikTok with their e-commerce store. They would immediately have ad inventory to fill TikTok and more demand to utilize their logistics network. I mean, yeah, I mean, that's, come on, $10 trillion company, here we come. Like, that would be incredible. I don't think it would be allowed to happen. I don't think Amazon would probably not do it, but
that would be incredible, though.
Yeah. But I think even if that doesn't happen, which seems unlikely, sneakily, Amazon might be just as benefited from a TikTok ban as an Alphabet or a Meta, because one, TikTok, and I mean, look, like Temu is not a real threat. I mean, ask people what they're buying on there and whether they use them. Like, it's just $5 knickknacks that fall apart in a week. But TikTok has been really aggressive in e-com, and there's been a big narrative around that. I guess it hasn't reflected in the stock price of Amazon recently, but they're growing quite quickly with their e-com offering in North America, and TikTok takes a lot of the advertising inventory for e-commerce stuff that Amazon probably had to pay for originally. You know, Amazon has a giant advertising business that they're trying to build and keep growing, and has extremely high margins. I think they could benefit just as much from, even if they're not direct competitors with TikTok.
Yeah, I think that's fair. We have got a question here. Is there a risk of China retaliating against TikTok ban?
Yeah, I think that's what I mean. I think Apple and Tesla could be interesting. And I mentioned those companies because there's been people in the Chinese government that have said, you know, in retaliate, basically there's been a lot of war of words from United States officials, United States commenters, whoever, that say that TikTok is a Chinese spying app, right? That's kind of the thing that they're trying to use to convince everyone that it needs to be banned. But then they come back and say in China and say, well, Apple products and Teslas are American spying products. So I would think they would look at those and say, well, you're going to ban our quote unquote spying product, even if they're not, we don't really know. And we're going to, you know, just go tit for tat there.
So that also happens to be part of your psychological short book.
Well, yes. I mean, that would do quite well. Yeah. I think that would make sense even if I didn't like either of the companies. I guess I don't really not. Apple, I'm kind of neutral on. Just get frustrated with how much people like the brand. But Tesla, yeah, I guess not a big fan.
We do have a question here. It says, do you guys still own Match Group? That's the video that popped out in my feed that led me to your live feed right now. Here's another example, side note, of the value of YouTube and how I wish incredible. There was a recommendation algorithm for podcasts like that on any other platform of choice.
Yeah, but Apple, YouTube. That's why I don't like Apple is that. Because they're so lackluster in that regard.
Yeah, we do still own well, I shouldn't speak for both of us, but I know Brett does, and I do as well. We both own Match Group.
Unfortunately.
Yeah. The stock that will never go up, as it's known around my apartment. But yes, it is frustrating to watch. There was actually, I think they were at a conference recently, Morgan Stanley conference, the Bernard Kim, the CEO, was, so maybe I can read that transcript or something, but I like it. I think the business is going to generate a lot of cash. I don't think Tinder is dead, and I think Hinge is a really, really valuable product to a lot of people, and people will continue to spend more and more money to find dates online, is my guess. That's my suspicion. So that's kind of my elevator pitch.
They got some potential activists in there to keep the management team in line. When their KPIs will recover, I'm not sure, but you know, good business, good unit economics, great cash flow conversion. Let's see. Eric says, thanks for the Nelnet episode, guys. Yeah. Hey, appreciate it. We put one out this week, over an hour long. Hopefully people enjoy that. If you don't know what that company is, go check it out. We think it's quite interesting. Either listen or watch. Anything else on TikTok, Ryan? Because we have a question here for you on home builders, which has kind of been a sector that you like.
No, I've never really been active on TikTok. We tried to put our podcasts out there for a little while, and it's just slow, and it's hard to track whether people are becoming longtime listeners. So it was a little frustrating. So I'm not missing anything by them being gone. And I think it's better that there's no chance they can dictate decisions in the US by influencing what people see. So I'd say I'm probably for it.
Yeah, I'm for it. Big Ten, especially since my psychological long in Alphabet, as I seem to just defend them. I don't know, for some reason I feel the need to defend them on Twitter, but it should help them. And for the show, hey, we put no time into TikTok and we put a lot of time into YouTube. So come on, you know, hopefully it ends up being the right bet. Come on, U.S. government. Okay, question. Does Ryan still have any thoughts on home builders using more option land nowadays, copying the NBR model? And have you guys looked into different Brookfield companies? We've looked into Brookfield companies and got lost in the maze, unfortunately, and just not putting in the time to understand those businesses. So the Canadians out there, you guys can make all the money owning them.
Yeah. No thoughts on Brookfield. As for the home builders, I was actually wrong. There are less, if I'm not mistaken, there are less land plots being optioned today than purchased, relative to, like, I think it was 2013 was the last comp. But there are certain businesses that have really shifted how they run things. So there's more home builders today that have really leaned into the land option model, but as a total, like, the pie as a whole, more people are buying the land outright instead of optioning it. I like the land option model. It makes a lot of sense to me. I'm still, I think, learning a bit about the home building business, because there must be some reason that a lot of developers, a lot of home builders choose to purchase the land outright. Maybe they get better deals on the land because they're willing to do a lot of they're willing to hold it on their balance sheet. I don't know, but I'd like to know why home builders still decide to do that when there's such an advantage to being asset light and letting it be on the books of a land bank. Maybe it's hard to find partners that are willing to do that. That might be a part of it. So for the businesses that have those partners, that's, I think, a huge advantage. The companies like NVR, DR Horton, Dreamfinders Homes. I'm trying to think of some of the other asset light ones. I think Pulte Group has slowly shifted to land options as well. So
there's so many home builders out there.
Yeah. I like the home building space right now. And to me, it feels like a lot of the bigger ones have big cost advantages that should last for a while. And I would suspect that the DR Hortons, the NVRs, probably the Toll Brothers and Pulte Groups of the world end up having a pretty good decade. Even if home prices come down a bit, I think the home shortage seems to be pretty real, and they've got the ability to generate good returns on capital.
All right. Well, I think that's going to do it. We're going over on time, but I should say we are recording. You are doing either pitch or stock report type show on Dreamfinders Homes coming up sometime soon, correct? So for anyone, yeah, is that correct or no?
Yes.
All right.
Maybe. We'll see. I'm a little torn, actually. There's a couple of home builders I'm looking at, so I think we'll title it the stock I like, the home building stock I like today, or whatever.
The home building. Yeah. It'll be something in that sector where I do have a lot of follow-ups I want to ask right now, but we are running up on time. I think that will be an interesting conversation because, yeah, some of these stocks have done quite well over the short term and the long term. It's an interesting industry. It's one we can all understand. And I think it'll be a fascinating conversation, especially with, I guess, maybe not Dreamfinders Homes, but there's a couple interesting ones out there. But yeah, I think that's going to do it. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in. If you are listening, watching, whatever, for the first time, give us a follow on Spotify, Apple, or YouTube, and give us a 5-star review on either Spotify or Apple Podcasts. That is the number one way to support the show. We've gotten some nice ones that maybe we'll read off at some point here. And then subscribe to keep up with the show on either Substack or Twitter and X. That's the best way to make sure you don't miss an episode. Let's hit a disclosure. We are not financial advisors. Anything we say on Chit Chat Stocks is not formal advice or recommendation. Ryan, I, or any podcast guest may hold securities discussed in this podcast, may have held them in the past, or may buy, sell, or hold them in the future. Thank you, everyone, for tuning into the live stream. Typically 9:30 a.m. Pacific time, 12:30 p.m. Eastern time on Thursdays on the YouTube channel. Link to that is in the show notes. We'll see y'all next time. Thank you.